Well, thank you very much, Alex, and thanks again to the RSC for hosting me for this term, and thanks to so many of you for coming out on a lovely day in what I know is a busy time of the year and busy time of the term, so thank you. As Alex mentioned, the presentation that I'm giving today builds on some of the themes that I introduced on the seminar on global refugee policy last Wednesday, so I'll make some reference to that. But it's also my first attempt to engage with a question that's really preoccupied me since 1998, and that's how we understand power in the global refugee regime. And here I want to give thanks to Jeff Crisp for a conversation that we had in the UNHCR cafeteria with Mark Cutts and Arafat Jamal in early November 1998, and some documents that you slipped to me at that point. And I think statutes of limitations have passed. I can now reveal that I got the documents from you, especially now that you've left the organization. So it's my first attempt to try and put into context an understanding of power in the global refugee regime. Developing this paper is the primary focus of what I'll be doing while I'm at the RSC until the end of May. So I really welcome any opportunity to discuss it in the question time that follows or in my time at the RSC this term. And the paper will then serve as a conceptual framework for a workshop at Carleton University in September 2015 and serve as the basis for a longer-term research agenda. So my hope is that this is the start of something that will grow over time. So I really value any suggestions that you may have. So to begin this talk, I want to take us back in time to 1998. Set the scene a little bit. France won the World Cup. A little company called Google was founded in California. The film Titanic won 11 Oscars, and the Spice Girls had the Christmas number one that year. So now that you're situated, let me take you to Geneva. As is the wont every year in Geneva, there was an annual meeting of the Executive Committee of the High Commissioner's Program, XCOM. And something that was new in 1998 was the idea that the XCOM debate would revolve around a particular theme. And the theme that year was international solidarity and burden sharing in all of its aspects, national, regional, and international responsibilities for refugees. The background paper that was prepared to help frame the debate called for this desire to identify practical ways of achieving or enhancing cooperation. There was a sense that in the preamble to the 1951 convention, there's this very clear statement that the problem of refugees or the needs of refugees providing protection to refugees is an issue of international significance and a solution cannot be found without cooperation between states. But the codification of a principle of burden sharing was not included in the 1951 convention. So there's this sense that international cooperation, shared responses to refugee movements was very ad hoc and very discretionary. Now, it was a very important topic today, as it was in 1998, but especially in 1998 for a number of key reasons. First of all, through the 1990s, we saw this very significant rise in refugee numbers, almost simultaneous refugee emergencies in different parts of the world, and there were pressures for early and often unsustainable repatriation. So if we think in the years immediately preceding 1998, in December 1996, we see the forced return of Rwandan refugees from Tanzania. In 1997, we see the forced return of Rohingya refugees from Bangladesh. So it was a time where numbers were getting greater, there were these violations of the norm of non-refoulement, and countries in the global north and the global south were really ramping up these restrictive asylum policies that we saw first introduced in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the non-entree principles in places like Europe, and the restrictive policies that we saw in traditionally generous host states like Tanzania. But it was also at a time where members of the research community, such as James Hathaway, were trying to come forward with very concrete recommendations on how international cooperation could be made more predictable, more reliable. Hathaway's proposal for a reformulation of refugee law premised around the idea of interest convergence groups, where responsibilities would be pre-negotiated before a refugee movement, so that when a mass influx took place, it was very clear how the needs of responding to the arrival of refugees would be apportioned. So there was a clear need, there were very clearly articulated ideas that existed on how international cooperation might be better codified. And so it lays to the possibility that, you know, given this convergence of factors, was this an opportunity for the progressive development of the global refugee regime? By articulating, by focusing discussion around this theme, was it an opportunity for the regime to do what regimes are supposed to do? Here are three snapshots of three very different kinds of member states of the executive committee. And just to take the temperature of what members of the executive committee said in response to this theme of international cooperation. I'll give you a minute just to read those because you can take the nuance from it. But for the benefit of those listening at home, we have comments from India, Tanzania, and the United States. India, that proposed the theme in that year as positioning itself as being a champion of refugee hosting states of the global south within XCOM and other multilateral fora, talked about this distinction between donor states who seek to relieve their responsibility as soon as possible, in contrast for developing countries of first asylum who need to obtain relief from the burdens that the presence of refugees pose to the host society's already hard-pressed condition. A country like Tanzania, which had, as I said, went from this status of being one of the most open and generous asylum countries in the world to one of the more restrictive, talked about this idea of countries of asylum being left to bear the burden on their own, and that whatever support they receive is as a result of charity and the discretion of states. And then you have the United States, who, let's remind ourselves, is arguably the most powerful state, in material terms, the most powerful state in the global refugee regime. Contributes a third of UNHCR's budget. Resettles more refugees than all other countries in the world combined. And by convention, the Deputy High Commissioner, that second most important position within UNHCR, by convention, that's typically held by an American national. So the United States, being a very important, ostensibly powerful state, it said we need to reframe the way that we talk about refugees, that we should drop this language of refugees being a burden, and we should start talking about refugees as a shared responsibility. So you have refugee hosting states from the global south trying to frame the debate in terms of burdens and helping to mitigate those burdens. And the United States, as the most significant donor country, trying to frame the debate in terms of shared responsibility. So what was the result? Well, the chairman's summary made it very clear that there was agreement in principle on the importance of international cooperation, but that this language, the debate around language of burdens versus responsibility, became a real sticking point. But that the majority view, the fact that refugee hosting states from the global south made up the majority of states within the executive committee, they were able to really emphasize this view that developing countries bear a disproportionate share of the burdens of hosting refugees. Apologies for the typo. One of the substantive results of this was a call for UNHCR's standing committee meeting in June to receive a paper every year that addressed the economic and social impact of massive refugee populations on host developing countries as well as other countries. And every year, well, the papers actually started in 97, but it continued through 98, 99, right through until 2004, 2005. These papers reinforced this rhetorical assertion that the mass arrival and prolonged presence of refugees was exclusively a burden. And arguably, it precluded, through a political act, a discursive act, it prevented more empirical considerations of both how the mass arrival and prolonged presence of refugees may constitute a burden, but may in certain instances constitute benefits for enhancing state capacity, enhancing regional development. And it's really only in the last couple of years, and here I'd mention the work of the Humanitarian Innovation Project, the work of Karen Jacobson and others, who've tried to bring in counter-empirical examples. And so now we see UNHCR, the Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migrations from the U.S. Department of State, now commissioning studies to look at the impact, both positive and negative, of the hosting of refugees. But the significance of all of this is really in relation to what we would expect this thing called the global refugee regime to do. As the presumed hegemon in the global refugee regime, the United States was not able to reframe the debate around this characterization of shared responsibilities. And likewise, there's a growing majority of states in the executive committee, refugee hosting states, were able to frame the debate in particular ways. It really challenges some of our assumptions about who is able to influence the course and direction of the global refugee regime. And back in 1998, as today, it provoked several questions for me. This idea of what it suggests about the decision-making bodies of the global refugee regime, the idea that since 1958, the executive committee is supposed to be this body that offers consensus direction to UNHCR. But did it really play that role? What does this suggest about the functioning of power in the global refugee regime? As a graduate student, I learned that the global refugee regime has this mandate of ensuring the protection of refugees and finding a solution to their plight. But is that really at the core of how the global refugee regime functions? And given these understandings, as Alex suggested in his introduction, what does this tell us not only about the global refugee regime, but about regimes more generally? And so to start answering these questions, it's important to take a bit of a step back. Since the late 1980s and the work of Gil Loescher and Ari Zolberg and others, we've had this understanding of the existence of a global refugee regime. But let's remind ourselves of some of the core elements of this thing that we might call a global refugee regime. First, there's a sense that the global refugee regime complies with this definition of regimes more generally. As Steve Krasner argued back in 1982, regimes are generally this set of implicit or explicit principles, norms, rules, decision-making procedures around which actors, predominantly states, might expect, might have their expectations converge around a particular issue area. So, do we see the core elements of what we might call a global refugee regime? Well, we have a set of norms, probably most prevalent being norme fondamentale. There are a set of rules, the 1951 Convention, UNHCR's 1950 Statute is two, and a decision-making procedures with the work of the Executive Committee, as I've mentioned. The results of these elements might lead to a particular expectation that the creation and the continued expansion of the global refugee regime will facilitate cooperation, overcome collective action failure, and help ensure the realization of the regime's core objectives, namely protection and solutions for refugees and other persons of concern. But more generally, it speaks to these questions of international cooperation. This is where the study of refugees can learn quite a bit from the broader study of international relations and cooperation, because it helps us ask the question, so what? Do regimes really matter? From a realist point of view, we would expect that the emergence of a state hegemon like the United States would encourage stability and predictability. Within the literature, a liberal view would talk about international organizations and regimes facilitating cooperation. But this little vignette from 1998 asked the question of whether or not XCOM does in fact provide this venue for developing collaborative approaches. And more generally, from a critical theory perspective, in the work of Keeley, who applied Foucault's frameworks to the study of global regimes, we get this view that regimes perhaps aren't these benevolent, voluntary, cooperative, and thus legitimate forums, but they're in fact real forums of contestation, that they're a place where struggle occurs and where the competing interests of different actors really come into conflict, which of course raises the question of how do actors exercise power within the regime? So just this one little vignette from 1998, along with any other example that you may want to discuss, suggests that hegemons like the United States don't always get their way, that regimes do not always result in consensus, and that power really matters. Now, this poses a challenge for us because understandings of power have been remarkably absent from the general study of what we might call global governance or international cooperation. So very briefly, and in the interest of time, I'll gloss over this, we can come back to it. One of the most important contributions that we do have, an edited volume from Michael Barnett and Raymond Duvall, talks about four different kinds of power that we see within the pursuit of global governance or the functioning of regimes. Good old-fashioned compulsory power, the threats, the use of material influence for one actor to exert direct control over another. But more generally, institutional power, where actors become involved in setting setting up institutions around particular conceptualizations of a problem and how that has an impact on control over socially distant others. Structural power, how the shaping of contexts such as the global economy results to core periphery relations within the functioning of global governance. And productive power, which is something that we see in a very interesting way within international institutions. And this is the very much the work of Barnett and Finnemore, for example, about who has the ability to constitute legitimate knowledge, who's able to define categories and legitimize certain definitions of problems. This helps frame a number of questions in understanding power and influence in the global refugee regime, that if there's no single expression of power, how do different actors employ different forms of power to influence outcomes, especially over time? And if not all power is exercised or experienced directly, is power the best term to use systematically? So, in thinking through the little vignette of the global refugee regime that I presented to you before, and this very brief snapshot of how we may theorize around power and regimes from the perspective of international relations and global governance, we can start unpacking a number of questions that can help frame the study of power within the global refugee regime. Where do we observe, or how do we measure, how do we know power when we see it? Right? Where can this amorphous phenomenon be observed or measured or studied? And what determines the ability of various actors to influence or exercise power in the global refugee regime? Is it always the same kind of actors that use the same kind of power in different contexts? And what are the different forms of power that influence outcomes in different contexts? But ultimately, and this is arguably one of the reasons why we engage in this kind of research, is how can a better understanding of power contribute to a more effective and predictable functioning of the regime itself to achieve those core objectives of protection and solutions for refugees? So, to begin to answer these kinds of questions, we need to first ask, where can we observe power? Now, those of you who've studied feminist theory will know that breathing is political, that power and politics can be seen in the everyday, that there are manifold instances where we can observe power. I would offer that one opportunity to observe the manifestations in the functioning of power is in the making and implementation of global refugee policy. And as I went into this in the Wednesday seminar, I won't get into it in too much detail, but it's essentially the idea that global refugee policy are those particular examples of where either formally or informally, this is important, formally or informally, the decision-making bodies of the global refugee regime identify a problem and agree on a proposed course of action to respond to a problem relating to protection, solutions, or assistance for refugees or other populations of concern to the global refugee regime. Building from the literature of global public policy from the late 80s and the early 1990s, we can understand that what's distinct about global policy is that it may have implications for one or two kinds of actors. Either it can take the form of regulations that define the limits of permissible behavior for national governments, so for example, XCOM conclusions, or programs administered by international agencies, such as policies that are directed at UNHCR's operations. Before I continue, I want to take a moment to redeem myself from Wednesday, where Alex asked me two very challenging questions, and I'll blame the confluence of jet lag and diminishing returns on cold medications that I think I did a particularly poor job of answering two questions from Alex, one theoretical on the differentiation between policy and norms, and another methodological that I'll get to in a moment. But, and this is just as an aside, I think increasingly that we can understand global refugee policy as being one example of a broader subset of what Barnett and Finnemore in their book Rules of the World refer to as impersonal rules. That there are a set of international rules that determine the limits of permissible behavior or encourage certain kinds of behavior from a wide range of actors. So global refugee policy overlaps with, and you can imagine sort of a big universe, a big circle circle there with a set of overlapping circles within this broader circle. So if the big circle is this question of impersonal rules, one of the sets of rules within that circle would be norms, a difference between, and here's a definition of norms that I would offer, a standard of appropriate behavior for actors in a given identity. A differentiation between norms is they may not be as formally adopted as policy, and they don't necessarily include this plan of action on how a problem should be resolved. They may, but they don't necessarily. It also overlaps with, but is distinct from, international law, which, strictly speaking, international law is a body of law that governs relations between states. So international organizations like UNHCR are not party to the 1951 convention. So there are these subtle but important differences. And of course, there are a whole range of other policies. But what I'd argue is that global refugee policy is one discernible activity within the global refugee regime. It doesn't claim to encompass all activities that may call themselves policy. But it's key in that it contains a formal statement of a problem and steps to resolve the problem. It originates in some way from within, formally or informally, from within the decision-making bodies of the global refugee regime, and it applies both to states and international organizations. So if we take that as a foundation, we can say that this process by which, and I won't get into the difference of product and process and product, but essentially to say that we can study global refugee policy either as the text, that is the actual policy, or we can study global refugee policy as a process by which different issues make it onto the agenda of the global refugee regime's decision-making body, that there's a step by which different policy options are considered and a policy option is agreed upon, that policies are formalized through a decision-making process, which may be through the formal acts of the global refugee regime's decision-making bodies, UN General Assembly, Standing Committee, the Executive Committee, or through much more informal ways, as Marian Friese will discuss in her presentation in a couple of weeks' time. But then there's this set of steps where policy becomes implemented outside of the global context of Geneva, implemented in a particular local context, and then eventually evaluated. Now, what I would argue is that an understanding of these stages by which policy issues come onto the agenda, are debated, are formalized, are implemented, and evaluated, this provides us an opportunity to identify and understand power. And this gets to Alex's second question about methodologically, do we study global refugee policy as a dependent or an independent variable? Do we study global refugee policy as something that has an impact on other outcomes, or do we study global refugee policy as an outcome, as a phenomenon in and of itself? And I'd argue that you can study global, and again, this is another aside to try and answer Alex's second question in a slightly more intelligible way. You can study global refugee policy as an independent variable. What impact does global refugee policy have on other processes or outcomes, as I've tried to do in studying naturalization in Tanzania? But global refugee policy arguably has little effect as an independent causal variable without the agency of other actors and factors. So the document of the policy itself very rarely serves as an independent causal variable. It may be a tool that other actors employ in their pursuit of agency in a sub-process, but we can discuss that later. But for the understandings of power, the process by which refugee policy is made and implemented provides this particular context within which we can observe which actors have power and influence in different stages, in different ways, in different contexts. So, yes, you can say what are the factors that explain the context of the outcome, but I think what's much more exciting is to try and understand the process, the global refugee policy process, as a context within which we can understand, disaggregate the process to see the deployment of various tools of power by different actors at different stages and in different contexts. And where this becomes very exciting is our eventual ability to understand variation. Is there variation between the role that particular actors play at different stages of the same process, as opposed to understanding the actors and factors that influence the same stage of different processes? So are the same actors that influence agenda setting in Geneva, are they always the same? are the actors that influence the implementation of a policy on protracted refugee situations, are they the same whether we're looking in an urban context or a camp context? Are they the same whether we're looking in Uganda as opposed to Pakistan? So what we can do is, with the use of these tables, we can start saying who are the different actors and what are the different stages of the process. So right away, what I'm trying to do now is to disaggregate who are the actors involved in the global refugee policy process and what are the forms of power that they employ or influence that they employ. This is really, as I'll explain at the end of my presentation, this is really the focus of the workshop in September at Carleton University, to have papers on particular actors and their agency within the global refugee policy process. So right away, I would start disaggregating when we talk about states. The experience of 1998 tells us that there are at least two kinds of states. There are refugee-hosting states in the global south who host 80% of the world's refugees that have particular interests and concerns. We may start differentiating between states in the global south that play more rhetorical roles of leadership versus those that host refugees, those that have more open versus more restrictive policies. That's something I haven't really thought through yet. Likewise, the question that was raised before about the application of refugee hosting states in the global north, how refugee hosting states in the global north experience policy. But where I will offer a differentiation is within donor states, and something that I've observed is a differentiation between the influence of refugee of donor states in the global north, those like Australia, who've been seen to lose power and influence, certainly in the policy formulation stage, as a result of an erosion of their moral authority as a consequence of domestic asylum policies. There's a sense that Australia doesn't have the same influence in the multilateral settings of XCOM and others because of this sense that they don't have the same moral authority. Unlike the United States, which regardless or notwithstanding more restrictive policies that they may introduce over time, retain a certain level of moral authority. Then there's the questions, in the interest of time, we'll go through this quickly. International organizations, certainly UNHCR and the work of Gil Loescher and Jeff Crisp and others on this question of UNHCR as an actor within the global refugee regime, the way that they're able to bring issues onto the agenda, the way that UNHCR is able to propose certain policy outcomes. But there's the question, are there other actors that maybe aren't formally within the global refugee regime, but maybe have muscled their way into the global refugee regime, such as the International Organization for Migration? There's then certainly a role for NGOs, and this is something I believe that will come out of Jeff's presentation next Wednesday, the way that NGOs were able to advocate for particular positions for revisiting of policies such as UNHCR's urban refugee policy. But also the question, given that a greater number of policies are being implemented by operational NGOs, do they have different forms of influence in the implementing of policy in particular local contexts? And there's a question. Then there's the question that I've asked Alex to reflect upon for the workshop next September. Intuitively, or sort of anecdotally, we know that there's a whole range of other actors, epistemic communities, diaspora communities, the private sector, refugees communities themselves, that have some kind of role in advocating for particular policy options or the implementation or non-implementation of particular policies in particular contexts. So if what we have is an understanding of the five stages within which policy is made and implemented and evaluated, and if we have a sense of who are the sort of clusters of actors that are engaged in this process, we can start doing something like this, which is trying to identify these particular moments where particular actors have or do not have influence over a particular stage in the policy process. Don't hold me to any of what I'm about to say for the rest of the presentation, because this is real. This is notes on a cocktail napkin kind of stuff. This is what I'm trying to do right now, is work from my notes and anecdotes and things that I've heard, particular examples of policy that I'm aware of, to try and say, with different kinds of states, different actors, UNHCR, different kinds of NGOs, other actors, who tends to have power or influence in putting issues on the agenda of the global refugee regime, in proposing certain policy options, in formally or informally deciding what the policy will look like, in trying to implement that policy in particular contexts, and then in evaluating that policy, ideally to then have an evaluation of a policy feed back into an understanding of whether that issue needs to remain on the agenda of the global refugee regime. And what we can start doing through this process, and I'm going to run through these are extremely preliminary understandings of what we might be able to do with this kind of characterization of moments and actors, is to start saying at that agenda-setting moment where different issues compete for the attention of the global refugee regime, we see that some, and here I'm informed very much by Marion Frisia's work and her work within participant observation, within the setting of the agenda for the 2007 Executive Committee meeting, that donor states, this is where I differentiate donor states 1, donor states 2, donor states 1 being like the United States, those who have not been seen to lose moral authority as a result of domestic asylum policies, tend to remain quite influential. Whereas states, and again, anecdotally, in the case of Australia, the idea that perhaps they have more limited influence as a result of diminished moral authority within the regime. Host states, and this is where I make an artificial distinction between donor and resettlement countries being in the global north, host states in the global south. It's an imperfect distinction, but one that I hope to be able to work through. That host states have a demonstrated ability to bring issues to the agenda through the majority that they hold in the XCOM structure. That UNHCR has an important role, especially since the proliferation of fora, the idea that it's no longer just the XCOM meeting, but it's the High Commissioner's dialogue and its side meetings and what have you. That NGOs seem to have an influence, but largely through other actors, in influencing the position that states take relative to the promotion of certain issues on the agenda. Other actors, like epistemic communities, seem to have a role, but it's much more indirect. And so what we can see is at the point of agenda setting that the primary forum of contestation or the primary contestation occurs between donor states, host states, and UNHCR. Whether or not that's true, this is what I'm proposing as a point of departure. In the policy formulation stage, donor states have demonstrated this tendency of loaning policy capacity and expertise in trying to provide technical expertise for certain policy responses to be adopted. That we see different roles for different kinds of states. Host states seem to have a limited ability to engage in the policy formulation states because of perceived capacity and vested interests. The idea of UNHCR and the power of international organizations, as we learned from Barnett and Finnemore, has this ability to, as a knowledge holder, to promote certain policy options given their expertise and their experience. And again, more indirect roles for other actors. And so what we see at the policy formulation stage, I'd argue, is contestation between donor states and UNHCR, and especially within UNHCR, different actors within UNHCR having different ideas of what policy responses should be. I won't dwell on the decision making only because I think we need to do much more in response to, so this is very much in response to a comment that Jeff made on Wednesday, the idea that increasingly policies within UNHCR aren't formally voted on by XCOM members, but there's a much more informal sounding out process where UNHCR will develop its policy on statelessness, for example, and take it to key members of XCOM and sound them out on that policy to ensure that there's tacit agreement on what the policy will be, to avoid the very messy process of trying to get a consensus decision from XCOM. So, although states have a monopoly on power, given the role of states in multilateral structures, that we see that UNHCR and other actors perhaps have more indirect abilities or more direct abilities if we talk about the informal venues of decision making. So that's something that can be unpacked. But where I think it becomes very interesting is how the tables turn when we get to the stage of policy implementation. When it comes to policy implementation, donor states have these very direct abilities to influence implementation through what Soros has taught us about the kinds of mechanisms that external actors can play to have global policy implemented in local domestic contexts, that donors do what donors do, which is to provide resources to try and exert pressure and capacity. But they have no sort of formal tools of power that we might sort of traditionally understand. Whereas host states, where they assert their sovereignty, and this is where it's important to understand the difference between host states asserting sovereignty as opposed to host states abdicating authority to UNHCR to provide long-term care and maintenance programs in very isolated and insecure camps, where states exert their sovereignty, they have a monopoly over the decision-making to implement or not implement on their territory. They govern the domestic context. So UNHCR then has these very direct mechanisms of influence, except where UNHCR is playing the surrogate state role, and here I borrow the term from Jeff and Amy Slaughter. And then you look at these other actors, the tools of influence they have to determine whether or not a policy gets implemented, how a particular policy gets implemented, and in what ways a policy gets implemented. There's quite a bit to unpack here, as we've learned from Phil and Alex's work on norm implementation. The process of implementing policy is one of those moments where power and interest really gets laid bare. So there's quite a bit more work to be done on how the policy implementation process sheds light on this question of power and influence within the global refugee regime. And then a stage in the global refugee policy process that really hasn't been developed, but what I think we'll hear quite a bit about in response to UNHCR's urban refugee policy, where are there opportunities for an evaluation of policy? Is there a contestation between the actors who legitimately can be seen to evaluate the implementation of a policy? Donor states, the U.S. Department of State, some of the Northern European countries, they offer evaluations of policy implementation. What impact do these donor state-driven evaluations of the implementation of policy in context outside of the jurisdiction of these states? What legitimacy do these evaluation documents have in terms of revisiting a policy, reshaping the policy, replacing the issue on the agenda of the global refugee regime? What role do host states have in evaluating the implementation of a policy on their territory? Do we see them as having legitimacy in their ability to advocate for implementation in particular ways? What we see is that states, UNHCR, and NGOs, in various ways and context, anecdotally, we know that they play some role in the process, but it's unclear what role academic evaluations of policies have played, and we have a very limited understanding of how the evaluation stage in the policy cycle really works within the global refugee regime. We know that a number of evaluations take place, but I couldn't say definitively what role this actually plays in the process. So in my final 3 minutes, let me move to some very, very preliminary conclusions. And as I said, this is my first effort to articulate this, so no one has thrown anything at me yet, so I take that as a very good sign. This is a very broad attempt to try and articulate a way of asking a very big question about a very slippery eel. To try and understand the exercise of power within the global refugee regime as experienced through the making and implementation and evaluation of policy. Just through the collection of anecdotes that I've, looking through my notebooks from 1998 up until today, the little notes that I've made about where we might see the exercise of power, we get the sense that different actors exercise power in different ways at different stages in the process. Not all actors are able to exercise what we might call direct power or compulsory power. So that seems to confirm some of what Barnett and Duvall argued 10 years ago. But it's very clear that we need to develop a more systematic methodology to understand what we mean by power, to clarify where and how we can observe power, and then to understand differentiations or variations in the way common actors influence power differently in different contexts, or how power is exercised differently in the effort to implement a common policy in different contexts. So I would argue that a more systematic study of global refugee policy process as a dependent variable provides a context within which we can develop this methodology. And I think that a more rigorous understanding of power will enhance our understanding of the functioning of the global refugee regime and may contribute to the regime's effectiveness and predictability over time. In terms of next steps, I've made reference to two of these. One is the idea of this workshop at Carleton University in September 2015. The idea is that there will be a series of papers that look at the role of different states, international organizations, and NGOs in the making and implementation of policy as an effort to start accumulating some case studies that can speak to each other on the identification and manifestations of power. We're hoping to have a video link between this conference and the RSC. So I hope that that there will be opportunities for participation, even though you may not be physically present in Ottawa at the time. It's the background paper, the first iteration of which that I presented to you today. That's what I'm working on here, so I really would welcome the opportunity to talk through this. It's a moment of anxiety to have an idea that certainly isn't fully formed, and to in an audience as distinguished as this, to push one's boat out. But if I can't do it at the RSC, where can I do it? So I welcome the opportunity to discuss this with you over the next 4 weeks. And I should also note that something that we're doing in the aftermath of this workshop at Carleton, we're looking to develop a new set of partnerships and to seek funding to support a new set of partnerships. Carleton University, York University, and CARE have signed a memorandum of understanding whereby graduate students can go and work in one of the 17 countries where CARE has operations looking at refugees or working with refugees and IDPs. And the opportunity for graduate students is to then go into these operations to be able to study the implementation or non-implementation of a particular policy. Our hope is to scale this kind of partnership up so that we have partners who are involved in the making of global refugee policy and the implementation of global refugee policy, and to increase the number of academic partners in this partnership, in this agreement, so that we can have a broader community of graduate students involved in this work. The idea is that if we have the best graduate students in the world, many of whom are present at the RSC and elsewhere, if we have the best graduate students in the world focusing their research in developing and employing a common methodology to understand the making and implementation of policy, if the case studies that graduate students work on are done in conversation with each other, it will generate this wealth of case studies from which we will eventually be able to theorize on the functioning of power in the global refugee regime and the factors that more predictably explain the making, implementation, and evaluation of global refugee policy. That's my 42 minutes, and with that, I thank you very much and look forward to our conversation now and over the next few weeks.